This should be part of the Genesis series. It's January 9th, the second shiur, on that same date. Okay, tonight we're going to talk about Kedas Yitzchak, the sacrifice of Isaac. The most obvious and philosophically difficult question about this episode is, how could God command murder? And we will address that question, but it'll be useful to create a much broader context. Rav Dessler has essays on a number of the parshios, the section of the Torah that I read. And his essay on this particular parsha, I've learned a great deal from. Most of what I'm going to tell you comes from there. And it will be helpful to look at the text, which starts on page 101. I want to start by removing an answer to the question, how could God commit murder? Command murder, which is popular in certain quarters. I know it from the inside. I grew up on this answer. That the whole point of the story is that in the end, God countermands the command to kill his son. In the end, it doesn't happen. And the way these people paint it, at the time the Torah came into existence, human sacrifice was very widespread. And the Torah here strikes a very modern, advanced idea that human sacrifice is impossible, unthinkable, immoral, against God's wishes. So the Torah takes the hero, Abraham, through the paces of the human sacrifice. And at the last minute, stops him and says, no, that's not what God wants. That's unthinkable. It's abominable. That's the thought. That the point of the story is to stop it and then to introduce the moral that human sacrifice is impossible. Well, that thought has only one minor drawback. It's inconsistent with the text. I must say the people who propose this thought don't really care whether it's consistent with the text or not. Their goal is propaganda. But I want to point, just call your attention to the fact that it isn't consistent with the text. Look on page 103. First of all, Abraham definitely understood and intended to kill his son. Verse 10 says, Abraham stretched out his hand and took the knife to slaughter his son. There's no question of its being play-acting. We may, at the further on, get to the Rashi and problems understanding the Rashi. At any rate, he said, Abraham, here I am. And he, the angel, said to Abraham, do not stretch out your hand against the lad, nor do anything to him. For now I know that you are a God-fearing man, since you have not withheld your son, your only one, from me. Now here it is. Here's the countermanding. Don't kill him. Why shouldn't you kill him? Because now I know that you're a God-fearing man. In other words, you've already passed the test. You don't have to go any farther than this. So don't kill him because the test has already been passed. How has the test been passed? Since you have not withheld your son, your only one, from me. Not withheld means you were ready to give him up. I told you to sacrifice him, and you were ready to sacrifice him. And since you were ready to sacrifice him, therefore you've already passed the test. Could you somehow infer from that statement that the text is against human sacrifice in principle, that it's an abomination and impossible? I don't see how. Abraham is being praised. He's being qualified as passing the test because when God asked him to sacrifice his son, he did not withhold him. And if you have any doubts, on the next page, the text repeats it. Verse 16. And he said, by myself I swear the word of Hashem, that because you have done this thing and have not withheld your son, your only one, you didn't hold him back. When I told you to slaughter him, you were prepared to go through with it, that I should surely bless you and greatly increase your offspring. Like the should be offspring. My text is a typo. Like the stars of the heavens and the sand of the seashore, and your offspring shall inherit the gate of his enemy. All the nations of the earth shall bless themselves by your voice because you have listened to my voice. By your offspring. So, that way out may be good for propaganda, but has nothing to do with the text. Text says clearly, if God commands you, then you have to carry it through. And Abraham passed the test because when God said to sacrifice his son, he was ready to go. Okay, if that reinstates the moral question, akasha. So we'll have to analyze the moral question on some other grounds. But to say that the point of the text to teach you that human sacrifice is impossible is just not right.
I see it as something that was still very difficult for him to do.
It can be difficult, but that doesn't mean it's wrong to do it. Adarabba. Okay, now let's take a look at some other aspects of the text. And then I'll present for you Rav Dessler's picture of the whole, which I think is tremendous, tremendous insight. First of all, in verse 2 on 101, God says to Abraham, please take your son, your only one whom you love, Isaac, and go to the land of Moriah and bring him up an offering, etc. What's a please? Now the truth is, in Hebrew, the word is no, nun aleph. No doesn't mean please. No means now. And indeed, Unklus translates no the way he translates ato with an ayin, the way he translates achshav, it's translated ka'an. But it's the polite form of now. And therefore, Chazal say that it always indicates a request. Why would God be requesting from Abraham to do this rather than just ordering him, as indeed God orders him on other occasions and lots of other people on lots of occasions? I have to understand, and Chazal have an explanation of this. Well, I'll tell you, but we'll have to go back and understand it later. Chazal say, God was telling Abraham, please stand in for me in this test so that it will not be said that the first 9 tests that I put you through were nothing. Lo Abraham mamash. If you look on page 100 in the commentary at the bottom, you'll see there's a list of 10 tests. Rashi has one list, the Rambam has a different list, but both end with the binding of Isaac. Now, I will tell you this. Listen now to how you have to read a Chazal. Chazal say, stand for me in this test so that people will not say that the first 9 were insubstantial. It's not enough that test number 10 be harder than the other 9. The function of test number 10 is to rehabilitate the other 9. It's not just that those were trivial, do something great, and you have something great. No, Chazal say, stand for me in this test so people won't say that the first 9 were nothing. If the 10th is much harder than the first 9 and he stands in the 10th and that proves how great he is, that's not going to rehabilitate the first 9. Indeed, one could say, you know why he put him through such a hard number 10? Because the first 9 were trivial. And that's why, to show off really what he is, you have to put him through a much harder test. Somehow, we have to understand how the character of this test rehabilitates the first 9. That's not trivial, yeah. Why?
You all needed the 9th to bring them up to do that.
It still wouldn't mean that they were substantial. You have to learn how to tie your shoes to be a runner, because if you can't tie your shoes, you can't run. It doesn't mean tying your shoes has now become a very difficult test because it led up to the running. Leading up isn't enough. Okay. Now, another element of the text that we read a moment ago. When the angel says, "Don't kill him," He says, for now I know that you're a God-fearing man. Okay, the word in Hebrew here is yira. Yira connotes fear and awe. One should ask, why is that the success? Now I know that you have yira for me. I could think of a dozen ways in which this success could be described. Now I know that you're courageous. Now I know that you love me. Now I know that you're dutiful. Now I know that you're self-sacrificing. You could have a dozen ways of describing what Abraham accomplished here. Why is this in particular the description? Another question. As I mentioned a moment ago, human sacrifice was very widespread at the time. I suppose we should imagine that on some occasions, people recognized the necessity of the human sacrifice and went willingly, and even gave over their children willingly. What would make this performance on Abraham's part so unique, so outstanding? If it's something which other people did, okay, they did it for their gods, but still, they were willing to give up their children, willing to give up their lives. Why does Abraham get so much credit for having done this? Then there's a fifth question, but I can't explain it until I answer the first four. Now, Rav Dessler explains as follows. We know that Abraham and Isaac were real people who walked the earth and had real careers. Part of each one's career was to embody a certain principle. The principle that Abraham embodied was chesed, loving kindness. The principle that Isaac embodied was strict justice. Let's look at the test through the eyes of each person with his principle. Let's see what the test looks like, what appearance it gives us. And then we'll be better able to understand what Abraham accomplished. Oh yes, I forgot one other question. I knew there was one I missed. The very first verse says, it happened after these things that God tested Abraham. God tested Abraham. This is what they call in modern primitive writing the topic sentence. You know, it's the first sentence of the paragraph. They introduce the subject of the paragraph. Well, if I were writing this paragraph, I would not have used that as my topic sentence. Seems to me that something's missing. Okay, it's true that God is testing Abraham. What about Isaac? Isaac just has to die, that's all. Doesn't that count as a test? If I were writing at the beginning of this paragraph, I would have written God tested Abraham and Isaac. Why is Isaac left out? Or if that's the will, address that also. Okay, so Abraham stands for loving kindness, and Isaac stands for strict justice. Let's start with Isaac. How does the test look from his point of view? Strict justice means everything is done in terms of desert, what one has earned, what one can claim by right, what one deserves. Isaac doesn't want more from God than what he deserves. Isaac will treat other people in terms of what is demanded in terms of that treatment, but he will treat other people with kindness because God commands it. Isaac says, what does God want me to do for other people? Want to be treated with kindness? Okay, I'm dutiful. I obey because I owe it to God to obey. I treat them with kindness because God has commanded it. Utterly unlike someone like Abraham, who naturally empathizes with people. He naturally shares their pains and their joys and their perspective, and is commanded to do so, but it's a different relationship. Okay, so Isaac stands for strict justice. Now, let's ask, in terms of strict justice, does anyone have a right to life? A right to life vis-a-vis God. Can anyone say to God, you owe me life? Let's reflect. The life of a human being is in God's hands. except for murder, let's leave murder aside, all other death is because God brings it about. Let's ask a radical question. Since God is described in moral terms, and we are told that God is just, and God is righteous, and God is merciful, and God is kind and loving, let's ask why, when a human being dies, and it's God who causes his death, why isn't God a murderer? Why isn't God a murderer? Here we come to a crucial idea. If you thought God created a person, gave him life, and then the person ran on his own, the person's life was something which was internal to the person, and then God arranged his death, that question would be a question. Okay, maybe there'll be answers, but the question would be a question. Why isn't God guilty of murder when someone dies? But that's not correct. That description of how a person's life operates is not correct. The truth is that God is giving life moment by moment. It's a continuous process. A human being is a little bit like a vacuum cleaner. Most vacuum cleaners still have to be plugged into the wall. So if it's not plugged into the wall, you can, you know, push the switch and run it around on the carpet. Nothing will happen. Isn't it a vacuum cleaner? Yes, but it needs energy from the outside. Without the energy, it doesn't do anything. A human being receives life moment by moment. A right to life would mean a claim on the next moment of life. It would mean that I could make a moral argument that God owes me more life. But once you understand that life is a free gift, no one owes somebody else a free gift. I'll give you an example. In this country, construction of apartments is a little bit haphazard. And they get finished at different times, and people are renting, and then they have to go to the new apartment. Sometimes you take up your apartment, there's no electricity. So what do? You find a kind neighbor, and you run a cable from his house to your house, and that's when you're in a new developing neighborhood. You see these cables going from building to building. You wonder what that's doing. It's not there for the aesthetics. Some guy's running his electricity off another apartment. So imagine Reuven is moving into his apartment, there's no electricity, and he says to Shimon next door, "Can you help me out?" And Shimon says, "No problem. I'm happy to help you." Runs a line. Reuven says, "I'd like to pay you for the electricity." He says, "No, don't bother. Well, but, you know, it's an apartment. You're not, you know, manufacturing things there. You're running a normal apartment. Fine with me. You can have it." 3 months go by. One day Shimon says to Reuven, "You know, we're moving new heavy electrical equipment into our house. Next week I'm going to have to cut it off. You'll have to find another source of electricity." Can Reuven say he's being cheated, treated unjustly? His rights are being trampled? He doesn't have any right to free electricity. Shimon, the goodness of heart, gave him free electricity for 3 months. All Reuven should do is say, "Thank you very much." And if Reuven claims that he's surprised by this and he built expectations on getting electricity and so forth and so on, let's imagine that every week Shimon drops a note in Reuven's mailbox. "Listen, this might end at any time. I just want you to be prepared. I mean, I don't think death is really a surprise to people. You know, you could read about it in Genesis, and if you have an allergy to Genesis, you can read the old bits in the Times. People die." So when a person dies, there's no complaint against God that God is a murderer. If person A ends person B's life, that's called murder, because usually he has no right to do so. He's not the court executioner. He's not firing in self-defense. And that being the case, he's depriving B of life that he would have otherwise had. Here, God says, "I'm not giving you any more life. I've been giving up until now. I'm not giving you any more life." Okay, that's when God ends the life of a person other than through murder. Leave alone murder for a moment. Now, God says to Abraham, "I'm commanding you to kill Isaac." When God arranges for a person to die, there's any number of different ways a person can die. He can fall off a cliff, he can be bitten by a snake, he can have a heart attack, he can die of pneumonia. I mean, people die in lots of different ways. In this case, God says, I want him to die by his father executing him. From the point of view of God's moral authority to determine the end of a life, I don't think it makes any difference whatsoever how the person dies. So looking at this event from Isaac's point of view, Isaac says, ending of my life? I never had a right to life. I don't have a demand on life. And since I live according to the principle of strict justice, and I know very well that according to the principle of strict justice, I have no right to life, that being the case, I'm prepared to accept my death. Here's the key point, this is what Rav Tesler says. Not to say that this is easy for Isaac, but it is a test to be true to his character, to live up to his principles, to apply his principles even when it entails a great loss. That's the nature of Isaac's test, which, as we will see momentarily, is in direct contrast to Abraham's test. Questions up to here? You got a question? Okay, now let's look at the test from Abraham's point of view. Abraham is loving kindness. The fact that Abraham expresses loving kindness is brought out at least two ways explicitly in the text in Genesis. One is the famous incident when he services the travelers, even though they're, according to the tradition anyway, idol worshippers. But he services them and takes care of their needs. Even more striking, says Rav Tesler, is when he pleads on behalf of the people of Sodom. According to the oral tradition, Sodom was an anti-chesed society. It was built on the early capitalist ethic, earn your way, earn your keep, no free rides. We don't want lazy, irresponsible people over here. That's why the angels said we'll sleep in the street. Either you rent a room in the local hotel, or get out. None of this freeloading. So now, Abraham's whole life, his whole essence is built on chesed. Here you have an anti-chesed society. This, by the way, is the classical paradox of liberalism, only 3,800 years ago. Can a person who represents chesed extend it even to those who have an opposite point of view of anti-chesed? Or shall he say, listen, my purpose is to spread chesed in the world, and these people are against it, so to extend chesed to them is self-defeating, because their practice as whole is entirely anti-chesed. Abraham's solution, I'm not saying this in logic is the only possible solution, but Abraham's solution is to apply chesed across the board without restrictions, even to an anti-chesed society. To such a person, God says, you have to sacrifice your son. His son, who is, of course, not a vicious criminal, not an anti-chesed person. And this isn't a stranger, like the people of Sodom. This is someone whom Abraham loves, his own flesh and blood, his own son. So, Abraham expressing loving kindness, this is in direct contradiction to what he lives for. But it's even worse than that. Because prior to this incident, God promises Abraham that Isaac will be his continuation. And Isaac has no children. So God here is contradicting himself in his relationship with Abraham. So much so that one of the great commentators, the Shulchan Aruch Kodesh, says that if Abraham had refused to kill Isaac, he would have been within his rights. Because Abraham would say to God, listen, you told me X and you told me Y. They can't both be true. They can't make them both true. So I guess I have to choose. Well, I choose X. I choose to keep him alive. Like the prior statement. Other commentators don't go that far, but there is a contradiction here. So Abraham's understanding of God, identification with God, amalgamation with God, connection with God is also undone. Abraham's love for his son is contradicted. His love for God is contradicted. This test is designed to make him act out of character, against his character. That's the profound difference between the test that Isaac had to undergo from his perspective versus the test that Abraham had to undergo from his perspective. Now it says Rav Dessler, as an exponent of Musar, the Torah wants to stress here that it's not enough to act on your talents and strengths and to ignore those parts of your character and personality which are weak. True, you can give priority to the strong side, but you can't just ignore the weak side. A person has to work on all aspects of his character. So here, the Torah wants to make prominent the responsibility a person has to work on all parts of his character, even those that are weaker and less natural, less outstanding. That's why the first verse says God tested Abraham. Of course, Isaac's being tested, but the character of the test is not what the Torah wants to stress. I will just mention here that there was an ancient Greek playwright called Aristophanes who wrote a play called The Clouds. This play was a satire making fun of Socrates. It pictured a person who was a philosopher but who couldn't remember his wife's name or birthday and couldn't remember where he lived and couldn't remember where he left his cloak, you know, because his head are in the clouds, his feet are in the clouds, he's an incompetent social human being. I don't know if that really actually describes Socrates, but we would be in sympathy with Aristophanes' satire. A person can use his scholarship to ignore his other human responsibilities is not correct. That's not appropriate. Yes, there could be emphasis, but the person is not allowed to simply ignore those aspects of life in which he's weak. And here, Abraham was required to act out of character. This explains why the result is, now I know you're a God-fearing man. Where fear may be, where the word yira, it's maybe fear, but it also connotes awe. Why doesn't it say, now I know that you love me, now that you're courageous, now that you're out? Because the element that's expressed here, the way of understanding how Abraham was able to do what he did, is yira. Yira means the sense of overwhelming greatness. God's overwhelming greatness and my smallness, my insignificance, my inability to really understand. Because indeed, from Abraham's point of view, this test had no meaning. This test had no rationale. It even contradicted what God himself had told him. At a certain point, he has to think, well, if God commanded me this now, then I didn't understand what he told me before. If I didn't understand what he told me before, so how much do I understand altogether? Do I know what I'm doing? Do I know why I'm doing it? The only thing that can carry a person through under those conditions is yira, where he says that God is overwhelmingly greater than I. Now we come to the fifth question, which I've already started to answer, but it needs a little more elaboration. If the test is designed to undercut Abraham's essence, where does he get the motivation to do it? You know, to be able to respond means something in you says yes. Something in you identifies. If this was designed to undercut everything Abraham stood for and identified with, what was left in him to be able to respond? That's the idea of yira. Now, there are two ways to read yira. One way, which is made famous by a certain non-Jewish philosopher, Soren Kierkegaard, fear and trembling, which is dead wrong, which isn't his fault. How much do you know? Right? And the other way, which I think is correct. When you say that something is overwhelmingly beyond me, I can't really fathom it. I can't really understand it. There are two ways to go. You could say, and therefore it's really absurd. It has no meaning at all. My whole concept of meaning is irrelevant when it comes to an infinite God. And therefore, of course it doesn't have any meaning for me because it really is, from my point of view, meaningless. And it's still important to do it because he's bigger than I am. I don't think that's correct. The right reading here is this test has a meaning. And the meaning it has is something that I can understand. I just don't understand it because I haven't seen enough. Not enough has been revealed to me. But it's not something that's inherently beyond my ability to understand. The idea that there's something that a human being has to do that's inherently beyond his ability to understand is from our sources incorrect. Maybe there's a limitation to what you can understand in this condition, but not beyond human understanding. God says to Moses, you're asking to see me? No man can see me and live. Okay, no man can see me and live. But if he's gone beyond life, then he can see. The red heifer, the famous chok, that which is presented as having no meaning at all. The Midrash says otherwise. The Midrash says that Solomon exerted himself to try to understand and said, it's distant from me. But the same Midrash says that Moses did understand and that at the time of the Messiah, all Jews will understand. What's the message of that Midrash? The message is, if you're going to use human wisdom to understand, you're not going to get it. But prophecy could give it to you. It requires an injection from outside. But Moses got it from God, and in the times of the Messiah, we'll all get it from God. So it definitely has a reason. It has a reason that human beings can understand, just not under these conditions. Yirah, or is, it has an explanation, and even though to me it seems like it couldn't possibly have an explanation, my vision is limited, it's wrong. And it really does have an explanation. This was Abraham's trust that it really does have an explanation, even though he couldn't see how that could possibly be true. And since someone who acts on the basis of love acts on the basis of what he does understand, love is always predicated on understanding. You can't love an X, something that's beyond you entirely. So Abraham had to act utterly out of character here. And that's how he carried it through. So, what we have so far is an explanation of what it looked like from Isaac's point of view. And from Isaac's point of view, we've answered the question, how can God command murder? Let me put the answer as short and as pointed as possible. If God commands it, it's not murder. The question was based on a prejudiced formulation of the fact. How can God command murder? Presumes that it's murder. What is murder? Murder means unjustified killing. If A kills B in self-defense to save his life, that's not murder. If the court, following appropriate judicial procedure, kills a criminal, that's not murder. Okay, people are against capital punishment, call it murder. That's just to fire up people's emotions. Murder is unjustified killing. If God says to Abraham, kill your son Isaac, then God is ending Isaac's life, as Isaac could die from a heart attack or die by falling off a cliff, and no one would have any complaints to God. How come you ended his life? We would say life is in God's hands, especially since he's giving it out moment by moment, and therefore it's up to him to decide how when it will end. Well, so he's deciding how Isaac's life will end only through Abraham executing him. So what? By the way, the Torah does believe in capital punishment. And there too, what excuse will you have for the executioner who executes the criminal? The answer is, the creator of the universe said, this person shouldn't live anymore. It's within the prerogative of the creator of the universe to say that a person's life shall end. And from that point of view, it doesn't matter how it ends. So the problem we started with, the moral problem, has a fairly simple solution. And I think this simple solution is what is pointed at by a famous midrash. There's a famous midrash that says, at the end of the whole incident, Abraham said to God, when you told me to sacrifice my son, I had a very good argument against you. My argument against you was, you told me that Isaac will be your continuation. Now you're telling me to kill him. That's a contradiction. I had a very good objection against your command. I didn't raise that objection against you. So too, Abraham pleaded with God, when my descendants will fail and you'll have a very good objection against them, so too don't you raise that objection against them, just as I didn't raise my objection against you. Now, aside from the beauty of the Midrash in and of itself, what I want from the Midrash is what it doesn't say. The Midrash is expressing Abraham's objection to God's command. The Midrash does not say, you're committed, command me to commit murder. You, the God of righteousness, the God of justice, how could you command me to commit murder? I had a terrific objection against your command. It doesn't even mention that. The only thing it mentions is, you contradicted yourself. I think it's obvious to the Midrash that the objection that God is committing murder is just silly. It's a non-entity. It's not even worthy of answering. Given what I've sketched for you, based on open, obvious Jewish principles, it is really silly. God's within his prerogative to determine when a person shall die. And how he shall die doesn't make any difference. If we're talking about death. We're talking about death and killing and murder. Then he certainly is within his prerogative to do that. Are we together so far? Now, the first verse says, God tested Abraham. Sorry, the second verse says, please take your son. And we said, Chazal tells us the please means, so that it will not be said that the first nine were insubstantial. Lo Abraham Mamash. So I said, that means that the tenth has to rehabilitate the first nine. If you look through the list of the first nine, whether it's Rashi's list or the Rambam's list, they all have one thing in common. In each case, Abraham is told to do something which, from his point of view, makes sense. It is expressive of his principles. It agrees with his principles. A person seeing Abraham fulfill these commands could say, what does this show about Abraham? It shows that he's a noble, idealistic, self-sacrificing, consistent person. He has principles, and he's willing to sacrifice for them and risk danger for them. There's nowhere in the first nine that you have explicitly doing it for God's sake, period. Transcending yourself. Transcending yourself. Only in the tenth, where the whole test is constructed in such a way that Abraham's understanding, his commitments, his priorities, his ultimate values are all contradicted. Only there do you sift out that motivation of serving God because it's God, not because it agrees with my principles. Only there do you get that purity of motivation. Now, once in the tenth test, you see that that's part of Abraham's character, then it's fair to go back and say, well, then, the first nine weren't done merely because they agreed with his principles. The first nine were also done as what we call in English worship of God. Because now I know that's part of his character. There's no reason to think that it became part of his character yesterday, just the day before he did test 10. So I can go back and read what's revealed about Abraham's character in test number 10. I can go back and read it into the first nine and rehabilitate them. And say that indeed they weren't insubstantial. They too were expressive of God's, of Abraham's service of God because God is God. Whereas the first, before the tenth took place, one could have suggested the lower description that he's only acting in such a way that it agrees with his principles. Okay? Now what about human sacrifice? Why is Abraham's achievement here so different from the widespread human sacrifice? Human sacrifice in the ancient world was a matter of economics. If you don't sacrifice to the gods will withhold rain. If there's no rain, people will die of thirst. Many people will die, and dying of thirst is not a pretty way to go. It's a question of sacrificing the one to save the many. It's a direct economic calculation. And by the way, lest you inappropriately think of that calculation as hopelessly primitive and savage, modern, so-called civilized, ethical societies today do exactly the same thing. Sorry? You don't need it for nationalism. You don't need it for the nationalist, the fascist politics.
John Nash.
Oh, John Nash. I don't know. But I think every modern society, except maybe one or two, has a well-known and well-supported institution built on the principle of having the few die to save the many. It's called the army. The army takes a portion of the population and sends them out to die to protect the rest of the population. And they don't ask you if you want to go. They draft you into the army. That's precisely what those people did in ancient times. They sacrificed a few to protect the many. And when you have the famous cases where the boat goes, the ship goes down, and they'll have the overcrowded lifeboat, and it's clear that life was going to capsize and everybody's going to drown, what do? Modern, sophisticated, ethical people, they cast lots and throw a few people over. They're killing the few to save the many. Where we disagree with those ancient societies is we disagree that human sacrifice can change the weather patterns. We don't disagree in our moral principles. We disagree in the principles of, and we, I'm talking about modern secular people. I'm not talking about the Jewish point of view now. So the use of human sacrifice in ancient times was economic. You want to get the rain. You want to get good crops. You know, many have pointed out the juxtaposition between this story and the myth of the Iliad, where the Greeks go to war against the Trojans, and they get into their boats, and then they fill up with soldiers and armor and stores and everything else, and the wind's blowing the wrong way. The wind's blowing the wrong way. It's blowing the wrong way. They can't get going. And the oracle comes to King Agamemnon and says, gods want a sacrifice. They want your daughter. And he sacrifices her to change the direction of the wind. That's the Greek mirror, distorted mirror of our case. Now, this is worlds away from Abraham. Abraham did not agree to sacrifice his son for the sake of any benefit whatsoever, or to avoid any evil whatsoever. First of all, God doesn't offer him anything and doesn't threaten him with anything. There are no stakes here. God simply tells him, do it. Unlike when the Torah is given and many mitzvot are commanded, and sometimes there are threatened punishments for disobedience and promised rewards for obedience. In this case, there's nothing like that. Secondly, what are you going to offer him? What are you going to threaten him with? Abraham, sacrifice his son. Well, boil in oil. Abraham's response is, heat up the oil. Sacrifice my son? You gotta be crazy. I can't do that. It's ridiculous. So there's no comparison whatsoever between what Abraham did and what was going on in the human sacrifice of the times. There's no relationship whatsoever. The reason that this passage is included in the Siddur, many people say it every morning, is that everyone comes into contact in life with events that he can't understand. He cannot analyze. And the only way to survive them is through Yira. Ahava, as I said before, love presumes understanding, something you can identify with. Yira enables you to respond even when Ahava is impossible. And whether for some people it's the Holocaust and for some people it's personal tragedies or other national tragedies, or imperfections in the world, whatever it is, when a person comes across something like that and he has no understanding, but I don't say there isn't any understanding, I'd say, but he doesn't have it, I'd say, how does he survive it? He looks back to Abraham and says, what Abraham went through was horrendous. And he managed to do it on the grounds that it was Yira, so I too have to exercise that Yira. It's become an emblem of Jewish response to events that take place that one can't understand, that there is an understanding, there is a meaning to it, there is a significance to it, even one that it is possible for human beings to understand, but we don't understand it now. I'll say that when the Mashiach comes, we look back through history, we'll be able to understand, we'll say, Atova Meitiv, that God is good and does good on everything that happened. So there definitely is understanding of these things. We just don't have it. We have Abraham as our guide, so to speak, that that's the attitude that one should take. One should also know there was a woman in the time of the Assyrian king, Antiochus. She had 7 sons, and he wanted them to bow down to him. And each one said no and was killed. And when the last one was killed, she went up to a roof and threw herself off the roof. And she said, before she jumped, to the son, she said, last son, she said, when you see Father Abraham in heaven, tell him he only went through the motions and he didn't sacrifice his son. And I sacrificed 7 sons. How will we compare what Abraham did with the myriads and myriads of Jews who died for the Torah, or who saw their children die for the Torah, whether it was the Romans or the Inquisitions? So the answer is this, and the answer is that once a principle has been brought into the world, it becomes available for other people to make use of it. The person who brings it into the world is the one who's the root of everyone else being able to accomplish it. This is true even in open physical terms. The fellow who first ran the mile in under 4 minutes was the famous British runner Roger Bannister. Up until that time, there was a kind of myth. People wrote that if you tried to run a mile in under 4 minutes, you'd drop dead. The human body wasn't made to do that. He did it. The same year, another 5 people did it. He broke the psychological barrier. Once he showed it could be done, other people sort of let themselves go and didn't hold themselves back, and they did it as well. Their ability to do it is to his credit, because he broke the psychological barrier. We have that in our case, that Amalek attacked us. Up until that moment, people regarded us as absolutely invincible, invulnerable. To attack us was unthinkable. Amalek attacked us, and people looked at us differently because he broke the ice. Right? Abraham brought the principle of making the ultimate sacrifice in a condition where you can't see the reason for it possible. Once he did it, you could say in open psychological terms, people think of him and say, he did it, so I have to do it. And also, metaphysically, he brought that concept, that possibility into the world. And in later generations, people are living off his inspiration. That's, I think, the true explanation of the story, including the explanation of how God commands what might have looked like an immoral act. Questions?
If human sacrifice was common at the time, what barrier did he break exactly?
Sorry, what?
If human sacrifice was common at the time,
yes.
Then what barrier did he actually break? What barrier, what obstacle, what floodgate did he open like Bannister?
Let's see if I can give you some example of what's going on here. I tried to explain that. They performed human sacrifice to get rain and thereby to prevent a number of people of dying. That's a common principle. You're getting a benefit in this world, one that's clearly worth the death of the few. The death of the few to protect the many is a calculation that people make under many circumstances. Here, you're not getting any benefits. You're not protecting anybody. You're not bringing rain and so forth and so on. God said to do it. There are no promised benefits and there's no threat and punishment. God simply said to do it. And he said, what God told me to do is more important than my understanding, more important than my principles. It's the most important thing in the world. That's the barrier that he broke, and that's the principle he brought into the world. The other is just enlightened self-interest. Maybe enlightened self-interest requires drastic measures, but yeah.
God promised him that the nation would come out of Yitzchak. Then why is it such a test? Couldn't he imagine that God's just testing him? Like he tested in the other...
That's why I recited verse 10. Go back and look at verse 10. On page 103.
Abraham stretched out his hand and took
a
knife and slaughtered
his son. No, you didn't read it right.
Abraham stretched out his hand and took the knife to slaughter his son.
Right. To slaughter his son. It's absolutely explicit. He took the knife to slaughter his son. He thought he was going to go through with it. He didn't have any illusions. He didn't think it was just play acting. And indeed, had he thought it was play acting, it wouldn't have been a test. The whole passage starts with God tested Abraham. Now, having said all of this, I want to add a footnote. If you share this with people or if you talk to people about it, you may run up against an obstacle, which you have to be aware. On page 101, the second verse says, please take your son, your other one whom you love, Isaac, go to the land of Moriah and bring him up there as an offering. Ha'alei u'sham la'olam. Rashi comments, Ba'alei, Rashi says, if you're looking in the Rashi, it's in the second column, the fourth line, first word. Lo amar lo shachtehu. God didn't say slaughter him. Because God didn't want Abraham to sacrifice him, to slaughter him. Ela l'ha'aleihu lahar, to raise him up to the mountain, la'asoso ola, to make him into the ola type sacrifice. Umisha lo, once he raised him up, amalo horidu, shehorideu, said, take him down. What does the word say? The word says, raise him up there for an ola. Raise him up. No, you raised him up and put on the altar. Finished. It's over. That's all I told you to do. Now take him down. Now, if you read that Rashi naively, baldly, it sounds like God never told him to sacrifice his son. He never told him to sacrifice his son. The words don't say that. All the words say is, raise him up. And once he raised him up, he said, take him down. Well, I suggest to you that that understanding of Rashi is absurd. So if the words don't say that, where did Abraham get the idea? He made it up? He had some secret private wish to kill his son? What kind of absurdity are we talking about here? It's utter nonsense. But worse than that, worse because it's more textual, just take a glance on 103 at the bottom of the page, verse 13. Abraham raised his eyes and saw, behold, a ram afterwards caught in the thicket by its horns. So Abraham went and took the ram. Now, your helpful, friendly translator translates it differently. Offered it up. But in the Hebrew, it's the same word. Vayalehu la'ola. He offered it up. He raised it up in place of his son. What do you think happened? He took that ram, tied it up, put it on the altar, then took it down, untied it, and let it run away into the thicket? Not exactly. He took it up and slaughtered it, and poured its blood on the altar and burned its body on the altar. Lahalos la'ola in Hebrew means to slaughter, pour out the blood, and burn up the body. Only it means it as an idiom. It's an idiom. Lahalos la'ola means to carry out the entire sacrificial practice as an idiom. That's the common idiom. Abraham understood God very well. When you say lahalos la'ola, it means carry out the entire sacrificial practice. That's what it means. But the Torah's commitment to truth, and I'm specifically saying truth and not emes here, because emes doesn't mean true or truth. That's another long story. I'm not going to go through that tonight. The Torah's commitment to truth has two dimensions. One is, don't mislead other people. Don't mislead them. Don't say things that will create in their minds false ideas. Okay, moral responsibility. And the other is, speak true words. Your words should be true words. These two dimensions are not the same, and they're not even, neither one implies the other. I'll show you. Imagine Peter and George. Peter lives in Massachusetts, and George lives in Florida. George is under the impression that Peter exaggerates. Peter has invited George to spend a weekend with him in Boston, and it's December 22nd, and it's been snowing. And George says to Peter, tell me, how much snow has fallen? George is trying to decide to bring his boots or not to bring his boots. Now, if it's 4 inches, he'll bring his boots. For less, he won't. Now, Peter says, what am I going to tell him? If I tell George that it's 4 inches, which it really is, he's going to say, oh, that's Peter. He's exaggerating again. He says 4 inches, probably 2, and he won't bring his boots. What do I have to do? I have to tell him it's 8 inches. Then George will say, oh, that's Peter exaggerating again, 8 inches. But if he says it's 8, it's probably 4, and therefore he'll bring his boots. In this case, if he speaks true words, he will mislead the other guy. The only way to communicate a true idea to the other guy's mind is to speak false words. What this shows you, this case shows you, that communicating correct ideas to the other person's mind is one consideration, and speaking true words is a different consideration. And neither one has to imply the other. Indeed, in the case that I constructed, you can't have both of them. Okay, the Torah's commitment to truth includes both. It includes not misleading other people and also speaking true words. What would happen in a case where you have to mislead somebody? You're justified in misleading him. What would happen in a case like that? Well, you'd have to speak words that create a false idea in the other guy's mind because the circumstances require it. Still, the other element of truth, is an independent consideration. And if you could speak in such a way as to create the false idea in the other guy's mind and yet use words that are true, it's preferable to do that. What Rashi is pointing out here is this. God is fooling Abraham. He has to fool him. Because on the one hand, God doesn't want Isaac to die. On the other hand, he wants Abraham to go through a test of being willing to kill him. So he's got to mislead Abraham. Got to mislead Abraham into thinking that God wants him to die. But the words that God uses have a true reading. They have a true reading. Of course, Abraham can't be aware of that. The words are an idiom, and in common speech and communication, they're used idiomatically. And Abraham has no justification in thinking that he's going to take it literally. That would be absurd. But when God says, no, I don't want you to kill him, he can also say, look, the words I used have this true reading, although it's not the reading that one should use in communication. I used words that have a true reading. I'll show you another instance of the same idea, which takes place before this, in Abraham's own life. On page 93, when Abraham tells Abimelech that Sarah is his sister, and Abimelech takes her to the palace, and God threatens him with death. And Abimelech asks Abraham for an explanation. So in verse 11, Abraham said, because I said, there's no fear of God in this place, they'll kill me because of my wife. That's why I misled you. I misled you because otherwise I would have died. And frankly, you don't have to die for the sake of not misleading people. Guy's going to kill you, perfectly okay to mislead him to save your life. Now he says, moreover, she's indeed my sister, my father's daughter, though not my mother's daughter, she became my wife. I said she's my sister. Is that totally wrong? Is that totally wrong? There's a, you know, sort of. She's sort of my sister. Now, if you take a look at page 77, you'll see exactly what's going on here. Look at the top of the chart. Terah has two sons, Abraham and Haran. And Haran's daughter is Sarah. So Sarah is related how to Abraham? She's his niece, his brother's daughter, right? Is she really a sister? Not really. Ah, but now you see the word bas. In Hebrew, bas, daughter, can mean daughter, granddaughter, great-granddaughter, great-great-granddaughter, as many generations as you like. Same with Ben. We're called Bnei Aaron Yitzchak and Yaakov, right? Abraham was not my father. But Ben can mean father, grandfather, great-grandfather as many times as you want. So, Abraham says, listen, Sarah is Terach's granddaughter. But in Hebrew, the relationship between Sarah and Terach, being his granddaughter, you could say that she's Bas Terach. You could say that, because Bas in Hebrew tolerates that. So now let's call Sarah Bas Terach. Great. Now, she's Bas Terach, and I'm Ben Terach, that we're brother and sister. Of course, when I said she was Bas Terach, I was extending the word to cover a granddaughter. And when I say I'm Ben Terach, I'm not doing that. I'm a direct son, right? Okay, but it doesn't matter, because in Hebrew you can do that. So she's Sarah, my sister. Now, when Abraham says this to Avimelech, what is he saying? You see, that's why I misled you, because I didn't really mislead you, because it really is true that she's my sister. What, Avimelech is supposed to know Hebrew and know that the words can be expanded that way, and that the Ben was not expanded, the Bas was expanded? Give me a break. That has nothing to do with justifying what he said to Avimelech. In the prior verse, he already finished justifying it. I misled you, because if I hadn't misled you, you'd have killed me. And for the purpose of staying alive, it's perfectly all right to mislead people. But in the next verse, he says to Avimelech, I want you to know that when I misled you, I used words which have a true reading. Of course, I didn't expect you to get the true reading, but they have a true reading because I care about that. I care that my words should have a true reading in addition to the question of whether or not I'm misleading somebody else. So here you have it. On this occasion, it's obvious. And in the case of Rashi's remark, Rashi's telling you that God himself used words that have a true reading, even though it's not the right reading to use in normal communication. And therefore, Abram did invent the idea of slaughtering his son. And that's why, at the end of the same passage, the same phrase is used for offering up the ram. And there it definitely means that the whole sacrificial order was carried out.
But Abram did speak to him in Hebrew.
To whom?
Abraham.
Why do you say that?
Because he had to use that terminology in order to extend the meaning.
Oh, no, I don't think that's right. He could speak to him in the Philistine language, right? And he's relying on the fact, when I said to you, oh, I see what you mean, I'm saying his words have a true reading. That's interesting. Must we say that he spoke to him in Hebrew? That's an interesting observation. Let's see. Must I say he spoke to him in Hebrew? It's a very good observation. I don't want to agree, but I can't think of a way out. I don't want to agree that he had to speak to him in Hebrew. Why should Avimelech understand Hebrew? And Abraham was a resident of the areas. He spoke all the languages, so he probably would speak to him in his language, not in Hebrew. Now, I said his words have to have a true reading. That's what you've correctly being bringing out. I said his words have to have a true reading. I'm just trying to work out that maybe it means the concept. I told you we're brother and sister. In my language and in my culture, I can express that in a way that has a truth. In other words, maybe I can squeeze out. I'm not positive about this, but I'm remember, we've distinguished two things here. One is misleading the other person, and the other is using words that are true, even when the person who's hearing you can't imagine that true reading. He can't imagine it. So the point here is not to say to him, you could have figured it out. That's not the point. Just like with Abraham. There's no way that Abraham could have said, gosh, this is an idiom. Everywhere else it means to go through the whole sacrificial act. But here, God doesn't intend the idiom. He intends the strict literal meaning, which isn't the way it's used in communication, and therefore all I do is lays him up and pull him down. That would be idiotic. If you'd use that as a justification, they would think you're nuts. You know, if the cop catches you speeding, and he says, you know, people like you ought to put water in their tanks instead of gas. So you go put water in the tank, it ruins the engine, and you sue the cop. You say, well, he told me to put water in the gas. excuse me. I was just telling you that if you're going to drive that fast, you should stay off the road. I didn't tell you to ruin your engine. It's just a way of talking. Right? Here, Abraham has to say, that's the way you say to go through the sacrificial act. Now, here, he says it to Avimelech in Avimelech's language. What he's saying is, the proposition I'm expressing is one which in my language has a true meaning. The fact that I told you in my language is a fact that could be understood as correct. You didn't understand it. That's true because I was misleading you, and I was perfectly justified in misleading you. To save my life, I can mislead you. So I don't have to make the meaning available to him. It's just that, so I did say the words you speak should have a true meaning. I don't know. I'm not totally satisfied with what I'm saying. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm just throwing this out there, but as both languages are from the same area, generally languages in the same area have similar idioms. Therefore, the concept of son of could have meant in both cultures any descendant of this person,
good.
Son or daughter.
Good. I accept it. Let me say it over for the recording. Yeah, he's suggesting that since the languages were probably cognate languages, they come from the same area. It could very well be that in Avimelech's language you have the same idiom, the same type of usage, and therefore it could have been. Without that, if someone wants to raise an objection, he's got to prove that what you say is not true. Now, say they come from the same area, of course, that's the secular way of looking at the way language is developed. But if Hebrew goes all the way to the beginning, then Hebrew is going to definitely affect all of them. So there's no question that what you say could very well be correct. Good. I accept it. Thank you very much. Very good. Yeah.
An addendum to that thought. Well, I'm not sure how Arabic works exactly. I'd assume this same concept would exist for bin in Arabic as ben or bat in Hebrew, where it would mean continuation.
Yeah, I'm there. I'm much more confident. I think you're right. Arabic, as compared to Hebrew, will definitely be related and overlapping. I just don't know what language Avimelech spoke. Right? We're talking about 3,800 years ago. Whether that's related to contemporary Arabic, I really don't know. But that's a nice. Anyway, I hope that the Rashi will not be misunderstood by you or by anybody who hears the recording. Okay.